It was Easter Sunday, April 15th, 1990, and Ray and Marie Thornton were driving along Snow Prairie Road, a rural highway, about 12 miles outside of Coldwater, Michigan. Ray was at the wheel and Marie was next to him, and the couple was playing a game they often played in the car to kill time on the road, trying to make words and phrases out of the license plates they saw. But things were quiet along the secluded back road they were on that morning, and they hadn't seen another car in a little while. Suddenly, though, a green Chevrolet van appeared in the rearview mirror. It aggressively roared up behind them and then passed them at high speed. Marie won that round of the game. She spotted the GZ on the van's license plate and remarked, "Geez, he's in a hurry." They laughed and would have thought no more about it if they hadn't seen the green van again a short time later. As they passed an abandoned schoolhouse, Ray and Marie saw it parked on the side of the building, but that wasn't all they saw. The driver was outside the vehicle and was carrying a large bundle wrapped in what appeared to be a bloody sheet. He was walking toward the back of the ramshackle old building. Although shocked, they really weren't sure about what they'd seen or what to do about it. Finally, Ray suggested they call the police and let them figure out what was going on. Marie agreed and wrote down what she could remember of the van's license plate number, and they kept driving, now intent on finding a telephone. And that's when Ray saw the van coming up behind them again in the rearview mirror. Gaining speed quickly, the van menacingly rode their rear bumper for the next 2 miles. Ray and Marie were getting more worried now, near panic. Who was this guy? What had he been doing at the old school? And worse, what was he doing now? Did he know they'd seen him dumping that wrapped up bundle? Well, Ray was speeding up and then slowing down, trying to shake the driver, or at least to get him to pass, but the van stuck to the back bumper of their car. Marie pointed to a side road ahead and urged Ray to get off the highway. But as he slowed to turn, the van behind them suddenly stopped and steered off to the shoulder of the road. Ray, angry and shaken by the dangerous encounter, now became determined to get the rest of the van's license plate number. He would give it to the police. He turned around at the side road and drove back toward the parked van. As they rolled slowly past it, Ray and Marie saw a tall man in a hat standing behind it with the rear doors open. He had a screwdriver and a spare license plate in his hand. The last thing they saw before they passed the parked van was a glimpse of its interior. And they saw that it was covered with blood. Now, if any of this sounds familiar to you, it's because it's part of the true story that inspired the opening of a horror film that was released a decade after these events took place. A film called Jeepers Creepers. It was the most horrifying film of the 2000s, but as it turns out, the terror that inspired it was even scarier than the film itself. Welcome to American Hauntings, the podcast dedicated to the history, hauntings, legends, lore, and the dark side of American history. And welcome to the latest episode of Season 9, a season we call Based on a True Story. American Hauntings is written and performed by Troy Taylor, that's me, and is produced and co-hosted by Cody Beck. And this season, we're bringing you some of the scariest and most unsettling films about ghosts, demons, murder, and mayhem that have ever been shown on the silver screen. But you can't watch any of them and say, well, it's only a movie. Every episode of this season offers the true story behind these horrifying films. Stories that are usually much scarier than anything a movie studio can create. This is episode 15 of season 9, Jeepers Creepers. Jeepers Creepers, which takes its name from the title of a 1938 song, was released in 2001 and follows Trish Jenner, played by Gina Phillips, and her brother, Derry, played by Justin Long, as they travel home from college for spring break. As they drive down an isolated two-lane highway somewhere in the Midwest, they're tailgated by an old truck moving at high speed. If an inanimate object like a truck can be sinister and menacing, then this is that truck. The truck then passes them and speeds off. They never expect to see it again, but then a short distance further down the road, they see the truck parked next to an abandoned church. The driver, a very large man in a hat and a trench coat, dumps what appears to be corpses wrapped in blood-stained sheets into a pipe sticking out of the ground. But then the driver notices them and chases after them for a while before forcing them off the road. Well, at this point, our protagonists begin making choices that you'll only find in a horror film, like going into the pipe that leads to the cellar of the church where they find the bodies of the driver's victims. Leaving the church behind, the pair go looking for help, but even the police are no match for the killer. At the station, they meet a psychic who explains that the killer is an ancient creature known as the Creeper, who awakens in the spring every 23 years and kills and eats people for the next 23 days. I'm not going to include much more of the plot, just in case someone hasn't seen this film at some point in the last 24 years. But if you haven't seen it, watch it. If you have, watch it again. I've always thought this first film and what became a franchise was great, although the sequels get progressively worse over time. And as we'll soon see, there are also some issues behind the scenes of the film that are, well, let's just say problematic. But where did the initial idea for the film come from? In addition to being inspired by elements of movies like Duel, Night of the Living Dead, and even the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, writer and director Victor Salva stated that the beginning of the film was based on, quote, a true story I was told, only it was a couple, and they went back to this pipe to see what he was throwing down there. I thought it was a tremendously brave thing to do, but I also remember when I heard it, thinking if this was a movie, if they went back, I would be on the edge of my seat. He also wanted the film's defining moment to reveal that the Creeper was not human. And to do so, he kept the character mysterious throughout the first half of the movie. When he made this choice, he went against the advice of his agent and a very established director who was also Salva's mentor and the main financier for the film. Francis Ford Coppola, director of the Godfather films and Apocalypse Now, that's some credibility there. Well, by turning what seemed to be a serial killer of some kind into the monster known as the Creeper, Salva felt he was making the film more terrifying than real life. But I'm not sure about that. It turns out the killer in the true story that Salva heard is more terrifying than anything that exists in fiction. Dennis Henry Depew was born in 1943 and grew up in Michigan, where, as an adult, he began a career as a property assessor. In 1971, he married Marilyn McLennan, who became a well-liked high school guidance counselor in Coldwater. The couple had three children, two girls, Jennifer and Julie, and a boy named Scott. But after 17 years of marriage, Dennis's controlling ways had worn Marilyn down. Now, this wasn't just the built-in misogyny of the era where the little woman did all the cooking, cleaning, and raising the kids while the husband worked and came home to sit in a recliner in front of the TV all evening. Marilyn had confided into her friends that Dennis was a bully, and disagreements between them often turned physical. And in those days, no one was going to do anything about a little abuse. What went on behind closed doors, well, that was a man's business. As time went on, Dennis became paranoid, sullen, and withdrawn. He isolated himself from the family and frequently accused his wife of, quote, turning the children against him. Finally, in 1989, Marilyn filed for divorce, telling her attorney that she just couldn't allow Dennis to keep controlling every decision in her life anymore. The marriage imploded, and yet during the settlement, Dennis offered Marilyn whatever she wanted. They split up their finances, and Dennis gave up the house with no argument, although he did continue to use the guest house as an office. And that would be the one thing that caused problems, thanks to Dennis's failure to respect the boundaries that Marilyn had created between herself and her soon-to-be ex-husband. One day, she came home to find Dennis sitting on the couch in her living room, making himself at home. She changed all the locks, but he'd still managed to get in somehow. When their divorce was finalized in December, Marilyn likely breathed a sigh of relief. Tragically, though, less than 5 months later, she'd be dead. On Easter Sunday, 1990, Dennis arrived at the family home to pick up two of the children. Joint custody had been part of their divorce settlement, but their daughter Jennifer refused to go anywhere with her father. He had expected to pick up Julie and Scott, but when he arrived, Julie decided that she didn't want to go with him either. Dennis was enraged and stormed into the house to find Scott. He started screaming at the boy, accusing him of stalling and treating his father with the same kind of disrespect his sisters were. He grabbed Scott by the arm and started shaking him. Marilyn tried to intervene, which just made Dennis madder. And then suddenly, he just became unhinged. Dennis grabbed Marilyn, shouting accusations, and in his rage, he pushed her down the stairs while their horrified children looked on. Dennis then charged to the bottom of the stairway and began pummeling Marilyn with his fists. Julie and Scott were crying, pleading with him to stop, but Jennifer ran to a neighbor's house to call the police. When she came back, she found Dennis outside. He dragged Marilyn out of the house with him. Her face was swollen and bruised, her nose was bleeding, and it was obvious she'd been seriously injured. Dennis announced he was taking her to the hospital, dragged her into the green Chevy van, and sped away. But the van and its two occupants never showed up at any of the hospitals or emergency rooms in the area. In fact, Marilyn was never seen alive again. The Michigan State Police and the County Sheriff's Office began a widespread search for the couple, but Ray and Marie Thornton spotted Dennis first, carrying that blood-stained bundle outside the abandoned school. That bloody bundle, by the way, was a sheet wrapped around his ex-wife's body. After Ray and Marie's last attempt to copy down his license plate number, when they saw the bloody interior of the van, they returned to the school and found the sheet before alerting the police. A dozen law enforcement officers were soon at the scene. A state forensic team closed the area around the school, stringing crime scene tape around everything. They immediately found the bloody sheet. They found a pool of blood on the ground and a set of tire tracks that later turned out to be a match for those of Dennis's van. But they didn't find Marilyn. The police already knew she'd been badly injured after the assault at her home, but the discovery of the blood and the blood-spattered sheet had investigators fearing the worst. And those fears turned out to be right. The next morning, a highway worker discovered Marilyn's body, not at the school. He found her in some brush alongside a secluded road that was about halfway between her home and that schoolhouse. She'd been badly beaten. And then she'd been shot in the back of the head and left alone to die. Dennis DePue, though, had vanished. In the days and weeks that followed, Dennis remained in the wind, but while hiding out, he mailed a series of bizarre, rambling letters to friends and family, trying to justify Marilyn's death. He sent 17 letters in all, postmarked in Virginia, Iowa, and Oklahoma, and in them, he ranted about the wrongs that he felt she'd done to him. One letter read, Marilyn had many, many opportunities to treat me fairly during this divorce, and she chose to string it out, trick me, lie to me. And when you lose your wife, children, and home, there's not too much left. I was too old to start over. 3 months after Marilyn's murder, he sent another letter. This one was 13 pages long and quoted verses from the Bible and contained long strings of incoherent ramblings about the unfairness of his life and about how Marilyn deserved to die for turning his children against him. And then he went silent. The police were no closer to finding him than they'd been immediately after the murder. The television was playing loudly in the living room of the Dallas, Texas home when the woman returned from work on the evening of March 20th, 1991. She wasn't paying much attention to what was on the screen, though, mostly because she was surprised when she pulled into the driveway and found her boyfriend's van parked in her way. It was unusual because he normally insisted on keeping that van in the garage. She could hear her boyfriend, Hank Queen, in the bedroom, and she called out to him. There was no answer, so she turned down the volume on the television. She finally noticed what was on the screen. It was tuned to the latest episode of the true crime show, Unsolved Mysteries. When she lowered the volume, Hank popped his head out of the bedroom, a look of surprise on his face. "Everything okay?" she asked him. "Yes, of course," he replied. "I just didn't hear you come in." She saw that Hank had a large duffel bag sitting on the bed. He was quickly folding clothing and gathering personal items and stuffing them into the bag. When she asked what he was doing, he explained he had to make an emergency trip home. His mother was very sick, he told her. Hank carried the bag into the living room, keeping one eye on the television set, and picked up a few other items and placed them in the bag too. "Do you want me to come with you?" the woman asked. "I can see if I can get time off work." "No, no," he told her. "I'm not sure how long I'll need to be gone, but you could do me a favor. Would you mind making me some sandwiches for the trip?" Well, she agreed, not realizing that he was trying to keep her distracted in the kitchen so that she wouldn't see the next segment of Unsolved Mysteries, which featured a story about a man named Dennis DePew who was wanted for the murder of his ex-wife. When Hank said goodbye to her that night, driving away in his green Chevy van, she had a strange feeling she would never see him again. And that feeling turned out to be correct. Hank, who was, of course, Dennis DePew, had left so quickly because he was sure that one of his girlfriend's friends would recognize him from the popular TV show and call the police. And he was right. Within the hour, state and county law enforcement officials knew who he was, where he'd been living, and had the number of the false Texas license plate on his van. It took Dennis 4 frantic hours to drive across the state. He was headed for Mississippi, but he had to cross a lot of Texas and Louisiana to get there. Louisiana state troopers were the first to spot the van. They tried to pull him over, but the traffic stop turned into a high-speed chase for the next 15 miles. Across the state line, Mississippi authorities waited for him, alerted by their counterparts in Louisiana and by the FBI. Dennis DePew was wanted for murder and should be, they were told, considered armed and dangerous. Warren County Sheriff Paul Barrett set up a roadblock, and deputies were told to shoot out the van's tires if he didn't stop, and Barrett had a feeling that he wouldn't. Dennis blasted through the roadblock, as the sheriff predicted, and they opened fire, hitting both back wheels, but Dennis kept going. He managed to drive on the rims for another half mile as pursuing police cars tried to force him off the road. Dennis leaned out the window and shot at them, shattering windows, but eventually the engine of the van gave up, accompanied by a cloud of steam, and it came to a halt just before 4 a.m. Deputies surrounded the van, ordering Dennis to throw out his weapon and surrender. Instead, he turned the gun on himself. A booming sound was heard from the van, and when an officer approached, he found blood spattered all over the window where Dennis's head was resting. He was still clutching the pistol, his finger on the trigger. The chase had ended, and the long nightmare that began 1 year before with the murder of Marilyn Depew was finally over. But the story that was spawned by the monstrous acts of Dennis Depew was just getting started. With a script completed and financing in place, director Victor Sava began putting together the cast, hiring Gina Phillips and Justin Long to play sister and brother Trish and Derry Jenner. The role of the Creeper had been written specifically for Lance Henriksen, who you might remember from the television show Millennium or from his role as Bishop in Aliens and about 100 other things. But Sava had worked with Lance before, but suddenly Henriksen dropped out of the project. Jonathan Breck, who had a number of TV and small film roles on his resume, auditioned for the role of the Creeper. After being told he should offer his own interpretation of the character, he shaved his head and then took part in the sniff test, where he was told to sniff the casting director and other crew members while in character. If you've seen the movie, then you know what that's about. Principal photography began in Central Florida in August 2000. It dragged on for 2 months, largely because this is precisely the wrong time to film anything in Florida. Not only is it hurricane season, but it's brutally hot. The cast and crew described the entire filming process as grueling. The abandoned church was located in Ocala. The diner was a set built in a nearby town, and an empty high school in Redick was used for the police station. A now demolished meatpacking factory in Ocala was used for the finale. And there was another little issue that came up during the filming. It concerned information that was known to school officials in the town of Dunalin at the time, as well as to a lot of people in Hollywood. But in those early days of the internet and before any form of social media really existed, it was still way under the radar as far as the public was concerned. You see, the film had been granted permission to use the streets near three schools in Dunalin. Plans had been made for students from those schools to visit the film set, and for some of them to also serve as interns. But when school officials learned that director Victor Sava was a convicted sex offender, those plans were scrapped. Now, you may be thinking that you're mistaken about what I just said, but you're not. The director is a convicted sex offender, and guess where the crime took place? If you guessed it was on a film set, you'd be right. Victor Sava was born in Martinez, California in 1958. His father abandoned the family when he was a boy, and he later claimed his stepfather was a physically abusive alcoholic. Sava developed an early interest in horror and science fiction films. And in 1975, a local newspaper reported that the 17-year-old Sava had gone to the theater to see Jaws 55 times. Before becoming a filmmaker, he'd also been a childcare worker, which, as you'll discover, should probably give you the chills. Anyway, by the time Sava graduated from high school, he'd written and directed over 20 DIY films. He financed the hobby by working two jobs. In 1986, he produced a short horror film called Something in the Basement, which took first place at that year's Sony AFI home video competition. Other awards followed, and this brought Sava to the attention of Francis Ford Coppola, who then agreed to produce Sava's first feature film, Clown House. Coppola was said to have seen so much potential in Sava that he gave him the same cameras he'd given another promising young filmmaker named George Lucas for his film, American Graffiti. But that's when things went completely off the rails. Sava was convicted of sexual misconduct in 1988 for sexually abusing Nathan Forrest Winters, the 12-year-old star of Clown House, and for videotaping one of the encounters in which he forced Nathan to perform oral sex on him. During a search of his home, child pornography was discovered, which led to Salva pleading guilty to lewd and lascivious conduct, oral sex with a person under 14, and for procuring a child for pornography. He was sentenced to only 3 years in state prison. He ended up serving 15 months, but became a registered sex offender for life. But unless you lived in the county where the crimes happened, or happened to be a Hollywood insider like Francis Ford Coppola, you'd never know about it. And Coppola, well, he was no help. He allegedly told Salva that his experience in prison, quote, would have value and make him a better artist. Really? Who cares? All I'd want out of his time in prison was to keep him away from kids. After his release in 1992, Salva laid low for a while, serving out his time on probation. He worked as a telemarketer during the week and wrote movie scripts over the weekend, which he delivered to producers all over LA while posing as a delivery person. You'd think that being known as a sex offender would prevent you from working in Hollywood, but apparently not. I mean, as I guess Roman Polanski and a lot of other people already know. And it didn't stop Salva either. Although the next film he wrote and directed was not a feature. It was a direct-to-video piece of garbage called The Nature of the Beast, which, when he was writing it, claimed in an interview had characters based on people he knew in prison. His next film, though, was a major studio film. A fantasy drama called Powder, about an albino boy with special powers. By the way, the studio he made this film for was Disney. And they claim they only found out about Salva's criminal record after production on Powder had started. Sure. And even if that was true, production had started. It wasn't too late to replace him. Instead, Disney allowed the film to continue and to allow Salva to work with an entire cast of young and teenage boys. Great idea. When the film was released in 1995, there was still no mention of Salva's criminal past. It wasn't until it had been out for a few weeks that actor and Salva victim Nathan Winters decided to come forward and call for a boycott of the film. Well, the media reacted, and so did the public, but not the way we would today. And the only good thing you could say about Disney is that they pulled the film from theatrical release. But then they ruined that by releasing it on home video anyway. Salva's criminal record barely made a dent in the news, and the should-have-been-disgraced and run-out-of-the-movie-business director was even given airtime to defend himself. He said in an interview, quote, "This has followed me around ever since it happened, but once people meet me, the phantoms go away and they realize I made a stupid mistake years ago. My past is going to follow me around for as long as people want to talk about it." As it should. This was not some isolated mistake. According to Nathan Winters, Salva had groomed him for a year before he'd first assaulted him when Nathan was only 7 years old. But the story came and went. There was no outrage, but then again, there was no Facebook or Twitter or TikTok, all the places where people get canceled today. In 1999, he made another forgettable film called Rites of Passage. And then 2 years later, he made the only film in his career that still holds up, Jeepers Creepers. The film became a success, bringing in $59 million on a $10 million budget. United Artists and MGM, who released and distributed the film, raked in the cash, and Salva's sex offender past was never mentioned. But thankfully, it would come back to haunt him. In the years that followed, Salva made 5 more films, 2 of which were bad sequels to Jeepers Creepers. He failed to find work for 5 years between 2006 and 2011 when he returned with a film called Rosewood Lane. Press outlets, though, at the time, led stories about the film with Salva's arrest and conviction. Times had changed. Salva made only two more films after that, including the horrendous Jeepers Creepers 3, and hasn't worked since 2017. And he hasn't been missed. I hate to say that I've always liked Jeepers Creepers. It's a scary film with a great concept. Would I have liked it as much if Salva's criminal record had been public knowledge when it came out? No, I don't think I would have. One of the big questions we have to deal with in this era of social media and a 24-hour news feed, whether you're a movie buff or a music lover, is if we can separate the art from the artist. Now, for me personally, sometimes I can and sometimes I can't. I think the only thing that makes Jeepers Creepers okay for me is that as terrifying as the creeper is in the film, the real monsters behind the movie, Dennis DePue and Victor Salva, are so much worse. Thanks again for listening to American Hauntings, and we hope you'll stay tuned for the postmortem section of the episode. It's coming up right after these messages from our sponsors.
Life's better with American Family Insurance, because we know in making the most of your home, DIY doesn't just stand for do it yourself. It also means dream it yourself. And we're here to help protect the dreams you're building. Save up to 23% when you bundle home and auto. American Family Insurance. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
I haven't seen a car in 50 miles.
You know what I just thought of, right?
Kenny and Darla.
You believe that story?
That they had to go looking for her head?
They only found the car.
They never found her head.
What's he doing?
The hell is that? He dumped something down that pipe.
Wrapped in a sheet. Is this your idea of a little adventure?
I'm just gonna look.
Hello?
You know the part in scary movies where somebody does something really stupid and everybody hates them for it? This is it.
Every 23rd spring, for 23 days, it gets to eat.
Eat.
What the hell is that thing?
It's stuck in reverse!
He must have 500, maybe 600 bodies down there.
You've got something it likes, one of you.
Jeepers Creepers.
Yeah, no, I'm ready.
All right, I'm ready.
Ready for a little more American Hauntings this week? Well, we are back with the American Hauntings podcast and the postmortem after the episode where we dissect this week's show. My name is Troy Taylor. I'm the guy who narrates and writes the show. And across from me is the guy who just asked me if I can help him move some things out of his basement when we're done recording. They look like maybe they're rugs, but they're wrapped in sheets. Should I be concerned here? Anyway, He's my friend, producer, sidekick, and co-host, Cody Beck.
Troy, you know I would never spend my money on rugs because they're so expensive.
True. I know, you're right.
They're so nice. That was one of the surprising things about getting older and like buying furniture and all that. Rugs are so expensive.
I know, but I like rugs.
Oh, I love
them. They're always cool to have, you know, with. You have these really pretty wood floors. I got really nice wood floors, but you can't see them because
let's make sure you know, cover this up.
But yeah, because I don't want anything to happen to them, you know?
Right. So. Especially when a bed sheet and plastic wrap does just as good. We're talking about home decor.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Why does it? It feels like we have not spoken in such a long time. Maybe I'm still the conference.
Oh, you know, I think, well, yeah. And I think it was also early because I had to go out of town. Remember, we were a little early on our last one, so I guess it's been longer than normal.
How was all of that? What you could talk
good.
About?
Or, oh, yeah. All of it went well. Yeah. All of it went well. And things have been busy since I got back. So it's been great. So
awesome. And you got more stuff coming up.
I do have stuff coming up in addition to going to film more things.
Nice.
Yeah, coming up soon. So, but we do have still a couple events coming up in August that are available. A lot of stuff's already sold out, but I've got a couple of dinner events, like the night with American Monsters, which is one I enjoy doing. A couple of dinner tours still. But the big news is that it's time to start booking for fall. And our tickets for our Haunted Decatur tours go on sale August 1st. So that is coming up just this week. And then tickets for the Alton Hauntings tours go on sale August 8th. So that'll be coming up too. Right now, you can still get tickets for the stuff that I host, dinner tours, downtown pub crawls, which we had our first one the other night, which was a lot of fun. Dinner events, Houdini seance on Halloween, a bunch of stuff. If you go to dinnerinspirits.com, you can see the stuff that I've got coming up, or you can see the websites for Haunted Decatur and for Alton Hauntings. Also, speaking of the 8th, my next book is out. The new Weird Highway Route 66 book in that series that people have been harassing me about finishing.
Yes,
the series.
Don't stop.
I promised I would finish it by the centennial, which that's next year. I only have one book left after this one because this one is Weird Highway Southwest. It's Texas, New Mexico, and Arizona. And that was when I was a kid, that was always one of my favorite areas to travel.
Yeah.
That's one of my favorite parts of Route 66. So this one was a lot of fun to do, to kind of put them together into one big thing. So, yeah, I enjoyed this one a lot. I think it's my favorite so far.
Why was that one of your favorite areas of that?
I don't know. I just like the desert, I guess. Yeah. I mean, I like to go back and visit. I like to go to Arizona, New Mexico and stuff. And mm-hmm. I don't know. Just something about that stretch of the road just is cool. It's just a cool part of the country, I guess. I've just always enjoyed it. So,
yeah,
you know, and even the California desert area is kind of fun to get to write about, too. So I'm looking forward to, you know, bringing that. This thing home to the Santa Monica Pier at some point soon.
You'll get there.
Yeah. Well, I'm getting there.
There's something about like the desert. And this is mostly me taking this from like movies and stuff, but it's iconic. And there's something about like maybe an adventure, a freeing solo kind of thing,
or
the intrigue of anything could happen.
Yeah. Desert noir is always one of those movie, you know, categories that I've always enjoyed. And I've always liked it. I like reading about it. I've enjoyed being there. I like the desert.
Yeah.
That one was, this was a lot of fun for me to do.
Yeah. Like, cause we talked about like, we love a good rest stop movie and stuff, but also I'm thinking like Gunslinger and stuff too,
right,
you know,
weird
Wild Wild West sort of things. Every time I call this man, I'm like, hey, what are you doing? Oh, just, you know, wrapping up two or three different books or, you know, working on bouncing on this one.
So well, I did try. We just talked off air that I did just finish another book, but it's not coming out until the end of November. So we got some time on that. Uh-huh.
Well, real quick, I did want to give a quick shout out to our newest supporters on Patreon. So thank you so much for supporting the show to Kaylee, Krusty Cat, Queen and M. Howe. Thank you very much for supporting the show.
I think that someone signed up. I saw that when I sent you someone that would just use the name Queen.
Yes.
Signed up. I think they just won
wanted us to say Queen. Just call them Queen.
Yes,
on,
Queen.
On the podcast. So, but if you are interested in checking out our Patreon program, well, season 5 of our alternate podcast is up right now. It's called Monster, and we have 4 other seasons for you to binge, but Monster is our podcast on Albert Fish, and we actually have 2 more episodes before that season is finished. So now's the time to get on there and binge. So anyway, we do offer that alternative show every other week, so it fits into the regular run of this show. So you get a new episode of it every week without having to wait. So yeah. Check it out at patreon.com/AmericanHauntings, and we'd love to have you on board.
Yeah, and please take a page out of Queen's book. If you're paying us, I'll call you pretty much whatever you want.
yeah.
You know, pretty much, but no problem with that. I want to dive into a listener review real quick. So this one comes to us from the UK, and it is from Saxby V, I believe, and it's titled Need More Episodes. Found your podcast after I'd binged every other one about any type of hauntings, spooks, and everything else weird. I'm from South Coast, UK, but I'm absolutely fascinated by all the American history and crazy stories. I joined Patreon in June, and I've already listened to every episode. Keep up the great work and banter. Dang, that's way too much of us to consume in 1 month. But
yeah,
but thank you.
I think it is too. But you know, but yeah,
but
we do appreciate it regardless. Right. So cool.
Okay. Are we ready for this one?
We're going to talk about this episode. I know.
Yes. Do we got it?
Yeah, it's it's definitely a horror film.
It is. Yes.
It's definitely got a story behind it. Unfortunately, the rest of the story is almost worse than the murder. I don't know if I'd say that, but
if we want to get out ahead of it, I really appreciated this quote you said. It said, one of the biggest questions we have to deal with in this era of social media and 24-hour news feed, whether you're a movie buff or a music lover, is can we separate the art from the artist? For me personally, sometimes I can, sometimes I can't. I thought that was such an honest answer compared to where a lot of people take hard lines. And I'm not saying either is right or wrong, but I love the reality of what you brought, where you're like,
well,
sometimes
it is
yes and sometimes no.
It is. I mean, I would always want to say, oh no, absolutely not. I will never watch anything by this person. I will never listen to any of this music again. But you know, people do. And I'm guilty of it, because sometimes I can separate the art from the artist, but sometimes it's tougher than others. I mean, it really is. And there are plenty of things that I have kind of taken out of my life because of the people involved. And then other times I look at it and I go, well, do I know the whole story here? You know, I don't know. You know, do I know, you know? And a lot of times for me, it's the older stuff, like much older, like, you know, I mean, you hear all kinds of stories, and this is maybe a little too old Hollywood for you, but you know, you hear all these stories about like people like Errol Flynn and things. But on the other hand, I'll still watch one of his movies when it's on, because I think, God, that was, you know, 75 years ago. What do I do here?
Well,
you know?
I think at this point,
Charlie Chaplin's marrying 16-year-old girls, but it's like, but the dude was a genius, you know? But again, you know, it's like I can watch Rosemary's Baby, but I don't have
Polanski.
To like Roman Polanski. Yeah. I don't.
Well, I also think a lot of it to me, Troy, is pretty much like, is this person getting my money or not? Like,
that's
what I actually care about. Like, for the most part, am I actively supporting this person or not? And with this one, look, horrible things, evidence, absolutely terrible. And you did even mention, you know, hey, had I known this when the first movie came out, would it have shaped my opinion? You know, like,
apparently this stuff had happened, but none of us knew.
Nobody knew about it.
I don't think I knew anything about it until the third one came out, which is terrible anyway.
Same here. Yes.
And that's when I found out about what was going on. And, you know, they tried to reboot this. I didn't even mention that the last Jeepers Creepers. I mean, it's just so horrific.
Yes.
And not in a good way. I mean, it's like all AI, like not even AI. It's all like green screen, and it's terrible.
Yes. Yeah. Right.
Did you watch it? I tried to watch it. I didn't even think I made it all the way through.
I think you told me that it wasn't worth it.
Yeah.
So and because of the complicated stuff I was like, fuck
it. And you know, when he didn't have anything to do with it, with the fourth one,
it's like
they kind of took it out of his hands and tried to reboot it, but it was just complete garbage.
Yeah.
And
And for me,
the third one
was terrible.
Yeah, the third one was terrible. I saw it, and then all this stuff came out. I mean, at least came out that I heard about. I hadn't heard about it before.
No, I don't think a lot of people had. And with this wasn't as tough for me because I had already purchased both of them way before. I've had them for a long time. So it wasn't really a thing of like, if I put this DVD in, he's not going to know. Like, you know, it's not giving him any positive praise or anything. Right. But yeah, it came out.
The first one is a good film.
It's a great film.
Yeah.
The second one.
I don't know.
I love the I love the scarecrow part in the beginning with the head turn. Yeah, I think we've talked about that.
I'll give you that.
And then something that a lot of horror movies don't always do, but like for a while, I felt like there was kind of the mystique factor, and you know, not seeing the monster and all that stuff. In the second one with the bus scene, like they have no problem being like, boom, close up.
Right.
The creature feature, like the everything is amazing looking. Like it's insane. As far as like the practical effects and things, you know, for that.
Sure.
But I love this movie. Fuck that guy.
I know.
But I know. I had no idea about the Francis Ford Coppola tie-in and stuff.
Yeah. That was a little shocking to me too. And you know, I don't know. He's a bit off his rocker these days anyway, but I really didn't know that he just said, you know, something like, you know, oh, that's going to be, you know, that's going to be great for your art. Really?
Yeah.
Going to prison molesting a kid, dude.
I wasn't even.
Was a financier.
Yes,
in the film.
That's what I meant. Okay.
I was bothered by, I didn't care about him financing the film. What I cared about was his comment. And, you know, for all we know, that's taken out of context. So it's not like, you know, let's not cancel. Well, not yet anyway. I mean, yeah. it depends on how much worse his films get, because his last one was.
Wait, did you see Megalopolis?
I only watched the trailers and read that he filled it full of people who'd been canceled. And I thought, OK, this is a problem.
He also
in a myriad of ways.
He won't let it be released on streaming or anything. He only wants it to be experienced in theaters. And so,
well, it didn't matter because no one saw it then either. Yeah. So nobody's ever going to see this.
And he's self-financed and it did not go well.
No, it was just some passion project that it was kind of like One from the Heart. Remember?
Yeah.
That
yes.
One?
Yes.
Also a dog. So, you know, he just needs to stick with. Well, you know, it's the ship sailed. You know, I think the Coppola ship has sailed. I think his best work is behind him. I don't think I'm out of hand saying that. Scorsese, I'll expect more things. I don't expect anything at this point. So, anyway,
I think he's done so. but I would love to talk about. Did you know Francis Ford Coppola directed Jack, that Robin Williams film?
No. I think I forgot about that. I think I did know that. For some reason, but yeah, that's it's terrible.
Baby boy whose body ages much faster than normal. Mm-hmm. Right? That was the director of The Godfather directed Jack.
Yeah, that's weird. I did not know that.
Yes, that's just one of the random facts. But anyway, the true story that inspired this film. I mean, it kind of seems aside from. I mean, they obviously embellish it and everything, but like it kind of seems pretty spot on as far as like driving down a road,
seeing somebody
with a body in a sheet that's bloody.
Yeah. They definitely took the first segment. I mean, anything after that, of course, is not, you know, there's no monster living under a church and, you know, attacking a police station. But as far as taking that first segment, yeah, it stayed pretty true to that.
It's pretty good.
Stayed pretty true to what was experienced by those people. But and listen, this dude was, you know, this Dennis DePue was, you know, mm-hmm. is a monster. Maybe not the, you know, coming out every 20-40 years to eat people, but you know, as far as just being a monster, he certainly was.
Absolutely. And I know we've made the joke before and everybody has done it, but you always have to be like, how did the monster get the personalized license plate? Like,
oh, I know.
In Jeepers Creepers.
Yeah. Yeah. Be eating you. Yeah, I know. I always wondered about that too. Did he show up at the, you know, at the DMV and,
right.
or maybe it was done by mail. Maybe it was done by mail, you know. I don't know. That's been a while, though.
You got to have.
If they were doing it by mail back then.
You got to have patience. Yeah. You got to make sure you send in all the right paperwork. And, that's tough. But sorry, Dennis.
I have a hard time with that, thinking that'd be approved either.
Yeah, that's you true. That's
there's
true.
A question there. So it's we're, a little... we're just going to go with it's not a real license plate.
Right.
That he made his own personal plate and or made, you know, ordered it. I don't know. That's a good question.
I wouldn't put it past him because when they go down in through that pipe in the movie, it is, I mean, it's, I don't want to say beautiful, but it's an amazing set piece. Like,
well, that is
like,
true. It is true.
It's absolutely insane. But the real life story with Dennis DePew, him sent 17 letters.
Yeah. Yeah. What a nut. I mean, obviously he's a nut, but I mean, you know, I mean, he slaughters his wife. I mean, kills her
in front of the kids,
takes off. Yeah. Beats her in front of the kids and then starts sending in letters to people, you know, saying, oh, it was all her fault. You know, that's classic. Talk about classic narcissistic abuser behavior. He's, I guess, be glad he didn't kill the kids, too, honestly.
Right. Oh, yeah, because he shot her in the back of the head later. Correct.
Yeah, that was later. He beat her and then drug her out and said he was going to take her to the hospital and then just drove off with her and left the kids behind.
Yes. When you moved on to the second part of the story, I literally heard the voice and it would just be like, Hank McQueen trying to keep his girlfriend watching Unsolved Mysteries. I knew exactly where you were going with that. You made it very clear that you were trying to show where you were going with that. And I wonder if it's, I guess, probably part of the excitement or the narcissism, maybe, that he even kept the TV on to kind of hear how much they knew about him.
Yeah, that's kind of what I thought. Yeah, that's what I thought, too. I mean, if you're that worried about it, dude, turn it off.
Yeah.
You know, but I guess he just wanted to see, you know, how famous he was or maybe to see what they actually knew.
I think it's an 80-20 thing.
Yeah, probably because he you know, wanted to know. I mean, the moron's still driving the same van. I mean, yes, he's got different plates on it. I mean, that's what the couple at the beginning saw him changing to his be eating you plates, I guess.
He
was driving around on different plates, but still in the same van. This guy's not exactly a criminal genius here. He's just not.
No.
And I think the story ends pretty much the way that you expect it to.
Yeah.
Him shooting himself on a highway. Yeah. I'm surprised he didn't get out of the van and start waving the gun around.
Suicide by cop.
Right. So they'd shoot him. But I guess, you know, I guess he wasn't that brave.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Coward took a coward's way out. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I mean that only in that context.
For sure.
You mentioned for the role of the creeper, Lance Henriksen is considered for the role, which I thought was very interesting.
It was written with him in mind originally, but then... something which has never been said, something happened. He dropped out of the project. My guess would be is that Lance Henriksen, who has a reputation for being this really upstanding, you know, cool guy, maybe got wind of some of his problems and dropped out of the role. Although, honestly, I kind of have a hard time picturing him with the makeup and everything. That's not really his thing. Normally he plays himself with his own face. Right. But, and he has an unusual look. I mean, he always has had. And so he's got a very distinctive look. And so maybe it was a little different, but I have a hard time picturing him with that makeup and, like, you know, the other things that I didn't spoil in the, because that scene in the police station when that happens, the first time you've ever seen this movie, when you find out that it's not just some serial killer,
it's badass.
It's impressive.
Yes.
It's very impressive. And so I didn't want to spoil that in case there's somebody who hasn't seen a movie that, you know, is 23 years old. But
I should have looked up the like special effects and makeup artists and costume creature designers and stuff for this, because I didn't, because they need shout outs like this. That was great.
Yeah, some pretty impressive stuff. Yeah. Yeah. And especially since it's none of it's CGI. It's all practical effects.
Yeah.
And it's impressive.
Well, and then you mentioned how Jonathan Breck ends up taking up the role and does the sniff test in the audition.
Right.
And something I wanted to ask you, I looked him up. He's 6'1". I'm not quite 6 feet, which pisses me off because Letterkenny, my favorite show and one of my favorite shows, their big insult they use is, you're so fucking 5'11". And that's exactly what I am. But Jonathan Breck, I know there's prosthetics and things like that, but I don't know if it's because of his presence or what, but he just, the creeper seems way bigger.
Well, I think there's a couple of things there. I think for one, I think he probably had some sort of height lifting boots. Yep. So that would have added a couple of inches. Plus, I think a lot of it was the way that it was shot. Whenever they would shoot him. I mean, it's the reason that Tom Cruise doesn't look like a midget in every movie he's in. You know, it's all depends on how you shoot it. It's all in the perspective. And I think they shot this so he looked a lot bigger than he is because, yeah, definitely the dude is, I mean, the character is definitely massive.
Yeah, because you know, now you mentioned, I did see Sir Ian McKellen and Elijah Wood next to each other one time in real life, and something was off in that Hobbit movie.
But
I also think there might be something to the presence of it too, where it's just, he's supposed to be terrifying. And so I imagine him being Charlie Brockes used to say, he would say, Cody, why did I always like remember your mom being 7 feet tall? She was 5'4".
Same kind of thing.
And you mentioned Powder. I have seen that movie multiple times as a child.
That was the thing. I saw it too, but I didn't know anything about it because that was all before any of that stuff came out.
Well, I didn't realize that it wasn't. I thought that I'd seen it because it was really, really popular. But you said the theatrical release got messed up, right?
Well, it came out and it didn't. It kind of got pulled, not pulled, but. They dropped a lot of the theaters right away because this was about the time this was all starting to kind of come out. But then, like I said, they put it out on DVD, but VHS probably, maybe DVD and other stuff anyway. But it did come out, and I remember seeing the movie and not knowing anything that was going on. But when you, if you should rewatch it. And I don't recommend
it. I was going to ask.
Not a very good movie.
Should I not do it?
If you rewatch it, you will find it very disturbing.
Really?
Because once you know what's running through this dude's head and you see the way this is shot, it is definitely, it's definitely problematic if you know.
Gotcha.
Way too many camera angle, young boys, kind of. It's not.
I do remember him being naked in a storm covering.
Yeah, a lot of weird stuff. Oh boy, in this movie, once you know about what's going on with them.
Yes. You know. Okay. I'm gonna let that sleeping dog lie then.
Yeah. You know, they still didn't make a big deal out of it, and they even let him defend himself, which I use that quote.
You thinking, did
really, dude. That is not, it's not a stupid mistake. I mean, it's not a stupid mistake when you're
monstrous act.
And he was 7 years old when, you know, and then it made the movie when the kid was 12. So it'd been going on for like 5 years before the movie was even shot. So that's not a stupid mistake years ago.
A stupid mistake is a public intoxication ticket, you know, like, this is not, remember the only other thing I remember is, the woman picking up the Moby Dick book and she's like, oh, I know a bunch of college kids couldn't get through this one. And he's like eating something. He's like, pick a page. And then he just starts like quoting it from that page. And I was like, whoa, as a child. That's about all I had. I mean,
basically I ruined the story here with adding in all his real life drama. It basically kind of ruins the, you know, everything to do.
Something
with the episode,
should be ruined if it can't be destroyed.
I found this kind of stuff was worthy of including because because of that, this is a problematic franchise, but you could forget about the franchise because really you don't need to go beyond the first movie. And you could watch the second one, but really the first one's the one that's scary.
Yeah.
When it first came out, I thought this movie was very scary and very well done. And I've always liked it, you know, just for that reason. But, you know, again, it's kind of my Rosemary's Baby here.
Yeah.
I'll still watch that one. But I don't watch anything else. And I'm certainly not going to watch anything else of this guy's. So, anybody's given him any money to make anything these days.
You know what, Troy? I will say if he self-finances a new movie tomorrow, I will not buy it.
I'm still not watching it. Yeah, me either.
Still don't give a shit. That's all I had on this. Check out the movie. The story's very interesting too. I had no clue that there was that much even of a kernel of a truth to like, or to inspire the idea even, for that first scene. So that's awesome. I don't have any Ghost Rider stuff, but I'm guessing you might have some
texts.
Hotline.
We do have some, and I think maybe I can knock out everything we've got here. Although this one's pretty long. This is really long.
People,
I put off last time because it was so long.
You gotta send shorter
text. I think I did. Hey, Troy and Cody, this is Tara from the 320, Central Minnesota. She said that she was camping alone in a state park in southern Minnesota when I decided to listen to the podcast and listened to podcasts and found most of them. I didn't like the way things were done because of the constant interruptions in the story being told. And that's what we've talked about too.
Yep.
And then of course, believing that everything they said is a haunting is true. But then I found your podcast and was hooked on American Hauntings from the beginning. Loved the story and the research goes into the story. Tell what really did and didn't happen. The myths and truth about a place, for example, the recent Bell Witch episode, learned a lot more about the haunting than I knew before. And what I'd learned before was that it was definitely a person who was behind the haunting and mostly involved the cave and Betsy. But with your research, I learned more. It talks about the postmortem and the fact that we don't interrupt. We wait to the end to talk, about the episode. Chemistry between the two of you is great, creates comedic moments. I don't know about that.
Your level
questions
of comedy,
Cody asks are sometimes ones I have not thought to ask, but help bring more understanding to the story. I've been entertained by the changes in Troy talking over Cody during his ending at times. You said that you couldn't and wouldn't do the podcast without us listeners. Well, us listeners wouldn't be listening without you guys. So anyway, So thanks for the amazing podcast. So I keeps her company on long trips and camping. So we appreciate
That's super nice. And I two things I wanted to say real quick. It's just one thing, but that's deliberate. It's why we deliberately decided when Troy, before you and I had even really met in person, we talked on the phone about, okay, let's split this into two different things, because it would have been so easy for us to, you tell me a story and then me ask dumb questions all the way through.
Because that's the way that most shows are.
Exactly.
So is someone interrupting and them stopping constantly, and then a show that, we might do 90 minutes or something, but it doesn't take us, an hour and a half just to tell the story because you've interrupted me so many times.
Exactly.
Or I've stopped, So I like to tell the story as one piece, and then we can spend as much time.
Then you and I interrupt each other at the other part.
Well, yeah, different.
That's how we do it. But I'm glad people are noticing and appreciating it. And thanks for the text.
All right. Well, this one comes to us from Christy in the 865. And she said, thank you for the episode about the Bell Witch. Made my heart happy. Being from Tennessee, I grew up hearing more about her. Searching for more information on her is how I found you, Troy. I've always enjoyed your stories, books, and look forward to the knowledge in episodes and seasons you would like to do on a Bell Witch as I... down a rabbit hole. Anyway, so stay cool, Christy. But we are working on that. That episode is coming soon. I know I keep saying that, but it really is. We're going to drop that episode about the Bellwitch Cave in an off in between week and just make it a bonus episode. But we're going to do the full thing. So, and that really will be coming soon. It'll be coming in August.
He did tell me before we started recording, guys. So it's actually going to happen.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I'm literally working on it. So this one comes to us from Ellen in the 618. And it's funny because two different texts came in. They're almost the same. It's kind of funny. You'll see why. Mm-hmm. Back in the 90s, my children were small. The town near where we lived did a nighttime swim. For $5, the kids got to swim, have a slice of pizza and a can of Coke. And they played Jaws on the big screen next to the pool.
Yes.
I laid on the hood of the car and watched the movie. It was a great night. Even though the kids were in the pool, I continuously kept looking for the kids, but it was one of the coolest nights I remember. And what's funny about that is that I got another text from the 707 that says, "Hey guys, just listened to your Jaws episode. Great stuff. Found a few things more. I find few things more terrifying than actual predators in the natural world that will happily eat us given the opportunity. I recently went to see Dangerous Animals, starring Jai Courtney, who does a pretty good job playing a serial killer who feeds alive people to sharks and films it. There was also some corniness in the film, but overall I loved it and made me feel freaked out in some parts, more than I felt in a long time," which is funny, but that's not the last part of it. I got to find it here. Here it is. Let's see. "Hey, Troy and Cody. This comes to us from Sue in the 309. She's our Oreo cookie lady.
Thank you again.
She said, "Hey, I'm late for this, but just listen to the Jaws podcast. It made me think of this. There are several places you can watch Jaws while floating in a pool or lake, which would be really cool. I thought I would want to be that person who swims around underwater grabbing people's legs just to see how fast they try to get away." That you would probably get in trouble for that.
I've heard about those screenings and like that's super cool. And like, just know that I love a good prank. Don't get me wrong. If you do that and you get drowned by someone, I will make fun of you.
I'm
on
not
this
gonna
podcast.
Feel sorry for you.
I'll make fun of you on this podcast.
Yeah. All right. This one comes to us from Jen. And this one says, "Hey, longtime fan of Troy's books and fans of podcast. Very lucky to have a pretty loose work environment. Plus, I've worked here for 20 plus years. So my boss is our executive director and allows me a lot of flexibility. So I love listening to the podcast while working on some of the mundane tasks I do. I especially love it when a storm is rolling through. It sets the mood. Yes. I'm the odd man out at my job. Not many love the weird stuff I do, but thanks for educating, entertaining, and making my work day that much easier to take." So
Troy, that is one thing I will say. Well, thank you for the text. And something I have been enjoying about the heat wave in the summer and everything is all the crazy storms we've been having.
I know.
Pull the curtains back and just like sit back, play some video games or like read a book or something. And just, I have been loving, because they've been chaotic.
Some of them, pretty wild. And you know, do you remember when we were kids, every storm wasn't like the storm of the century. Like,
that's what I'm now. That's
it was not like this when I was a kid, man.
That's kind of what
I
was thinking.
Bad storms, but geez, man, not like this. Like torrential rainfall every single time.
Sideways. So, and like sometimes there was a storm the other night where lightning was, I know there's a type of storm, but lightning was just shooting across the sky. It wasn't even raining.
Yeah.
And it was so, I just laid in my bed, looked out the window, and was just like mesmerized. Like it was beautiful.
It's wild. All right, last one, and this is just another example of our friends helping friends, people helping other listeners of the podcast. This is another Jen. We got a lot of Jens apparently listen to the podcast.
Jen.
This one comes from the 910, and I'm sure that is Charleston, South Carolina, because she said, "Just heard you mention ghost tours in Charleston. I lived there for a long time. I've done several of the Bulldog tours." She says they're the go-to folks in the city.
Bulldog.
So anybody who asked about that, and I said, I can't help you, but we might have a listener who can. There's your recommendation. So if you're looking for a ghost tour in Charleston, that's the recommendation that Jen is giving out to our listeners to check that out. So
awesome.
Anyway, if you guys would like to send in a message on the haunt line, you can do that at 217-791-7859. If you want to send in a comment or a question that's limited a little longer on the show, you can email Cody at AmericanHauntingsPodcast@gmail.com. So,
yeah.
All right.
Heck yeah. You want to take us out?
You wrap this thing up? Sure.
Yes.
All right, guys. Thanks for checking out the story in the postmortem for this week's episode. We hope you love the show. And if you do, we hope you'll share it with your friends, family, strangers, or even people you meet on the street. Encourage them to listen. And if you get a chance, we hope you go to iTunes and leave us a 5-star review. And don't forget that as an American Hauntings listener, you can use the discount code podcast for 10% off any books, tours, or events you purchase from our online store, because American Hauntings is more than just this podcast. It's also books, tours, ghost hunts, events, the Haunted America Conference, and the American Oddities Museum in Alton, Illinois. And you can find everything about us on the website, AmericanHauntings.net.
Troy, I did want to say, too, the last time I was at the Oddities Museum for the pre-conference thing, dude, you've turned that into something beautiful, man. It's amazing. It looks great. There's so much stuff. Like I kind of bounce around because every time I'm there, it's for some event or doing something, or I'm just passing through. But I can never get through the entire thing in one sitting because I don't have more than like a half hour. Because I could sit there and read everything, and you have like a new case or a new something, or
you'll tell me more stuff coming.
It's beautiful what you've done there, and it's well, awesome. Thanks, so, yeah, if y'all are in town, check it out. Well, this episode of the American Hauntings podcast was written and narrated by Troy Taylor. It was produced and edited by me, Cody Beck. To find out more about the show, check out show notes or go to our website at AmericanHauntingsPodcast.com. And if you want to find out more about the podcast, you can reach us via email, by text on the Haunt Line, or on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, probably some other social media spots that I just don't care about.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Something we don't remember. We just don't care.
Yeah. Thanks for listening. We wouldn't do it without you. So until next time, goodbye.
So long. We'll see you later.
See you later. Whew. Man, my headphones are so sweaty right now.
Oh God, yeah, I bet it's an oven up there, man.
I'm gonna.